This season of Well and Good is sponsored by Subaru, the perfect car for living a full life in New Zealand.
New Zealanders are doers, the type of people who are always pushing to sneak a little more out of life. We're up early to sneak in a morning swim, or out surfing to catch that one last wave. If you want to do a little extra, do it in an all-wheel drive Subaru.
Okay, so first off, how much do we love Toni Street?
Okay, I love Toni Street so much.
Oh my God, she's just a dream. I loved our chat with her because she was just so open about everything, her health struggles, which are, you know, intense.
Yeah, I was blown away with what she's been through.
Oh my goodness, I had no idea.
We had to do a bit of a dive into that. We cover, you know, where she's come from, how she got to where she is with all of her broadcasting that she does.
How she fits in keeping like a healthy lifestyle with three little kids, Mackenzie, Julia, and little baby Lockie.
Yeah, she's got a lot going on in her life. It's
she
amazing
certainly does.
What
she's,
she does.
She's a doer, that Toni.
She's a doer. She's a national treasure, and we have a great chat, and we hope you're going to enjoy it.
So welcome, Toni. This is so exciting that you're here.
I know. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So people are obviously very familiar with who you are. They've seen you on Seven Sharp. They've heard you on the radio. But I guess a lot of people probably don't know much about your backstory or how you got into broadcasting. But they know you're from the Naki.
Yes. I'm pretty Naki proud.
You're so Naki proud and I love it.
It seems like that's a prerequisite for being from the Naki. You've got to talk about it quite proudly.
I know, and it's like no one, it's like an unspoken rule. You don't have to, but everyone does because it's so amazing.
Yeah.
And you just want to always go back there.
I really wish there were other parts of New Zealand that were like that. Like, yeah, Auckland hard, you know.
Yeah, no,
but
that
Auckland
happen.
Hard. Auckland doesn't quite have the same ring. Really, eh? Can you imagine wearing that bumper sticker?
And the rest of New Zealand hate us enough already without, you know, bringing that into the mix.
Absolutely. Eh? Do you reckon part of it is because the Naki is quite hard to get to? It's like this little hidden treasure?
It's definitely isolated, and that's the problem. You pretty much have to drive 4 hours from anywhere big to get there, but that's what makes it quite special as well, because then you're not popping away on weekends. You're kind of stuck there, so you're forced to, you know, hang out with all the locals.
And that's where the camaraderie comes from.
Yes, I think so. And I think we punch above our weight as well when you look at some of the people that have come out of there. Jim Hickey, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so a bit of background, how you got into broadcasting.
Okay,
so awesome.
I grew up on a dairy farm in the Naki. And I was quite sporty, so I played a lot of netball and cricket. Cricket was probably my main sport, and surf lifesaving, because everyone did lifesaving in New Plymouth because it's got an awesome coastline. And when I was at school, I wanted to do something based around sport because I thought, this is my love, this is my passion. But I kind of just left it to the side because I thought, well, what job can you do unless you're going to be a silver fern? And I actually did go to university on a sports scholarship for cricket. So I went to the New Zealand Cricket Academy at Lincoln University in Christchurch.
I didn't know that you were such a cricketer.
Yes, I was. And it was really good because they paid for all your university fees to study. So I got my 3 years of study paid for to be on the cricket scholarship.
Amazing.
So I went down there because I was getting it paid for, and they had a business degree, which I did. So I did a business degree thinking I might get into, you know, when you do a commerce degree and it's like, I'll do marketing or something like that, not really knowing what it was. Mm. And then in my last year, I decided I'll give this broadcasting thing a crack because I thought being a sports reporter would be the ultimate. I'd watched April Iremia and Bernadine Oliver Kirby and I thought, yeah, that's a bit of me. I could, you know, just watch sport all day. So I applied for the journalism school at Canterbury University. So you had to have a degree to do it. And then it was a 1 year intense course of radio, TV and print. And I got into the course and there were 20 of us and it was hardcore for 1 year. And at the end of it, we had to do internships, and I did mine at Radio Sport in Auckland and was there for about a month and just helped writing the sport and everything. And we had to send out like articles, and I actually, my first ever article I wrote, which got put in the paper when I was a student, was on Dan Carter. And I knew if I could do a story on him, because he was a very hot property at the time, I knew if I could do a story on him, I'd have a chance of it getting published as a student. So I went through the back door and my flatmate was in the same hockey team as his wife. She was Honor Dillon then. She's now Honor Carter. So I hit her up and said, can I do an interview? And while we're here, can we interview that guy over there as well? So I did a story on Dan Carter's girlfriend who happened to be in the Black Sticks as well. And I got the whole back page of the Sunday Star Times as a student. So it was really good for my
CV.
Yeah. So I took my little CV and I applied for internships everywhere. and one of the places was TVNZ, and I got offered the Radio Sport one and TVNZ, and I chose TVNZ. But it was a hideous interview. When I first got to TVNZ, they interviewed me and told me that I had no shot of getting in because the course I had done was not the one that they usually took people from. So there's a three-year degree in broadcasting in Christchurch, and most of the people either came from there or the Auckland course, and I'd just done the 1 year after my degree. And so I left and said to Mum, Dad, nah, I haven't got that, let's move on. And then they called me and said I had the Auckland one.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a really bizarre way of looking at it from them. Like, oh, you probably don't have much of a chance because we only take people from these schools. It's like, well, wouldn't you look at the individual rather than...
In hindsight, I think they said that to me in the interview to see what I would say.
Oh,
and
right.
So I bit Throw back, you off I bit back at them and said, well, really, this is the course that I've done and this is what I've done to get into that course. And I think they wanted that response to see what
test.
I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I started at TVNZ on a six-month internship, and I started on the desk, on the assignments desk, where you looked at all the fire and police scanners and worked 11 at night till 7 in the morning. The graveyard shift.
Oh my goodness.
It sucks the life out of you, I tell you.
Honestly, I can really imagine.
Yeah. I'd be getting home at 7 in the morning and all my flatmates would be going to work and I'd just be hopping into bed. It was like no life.
And it's hard to sleep during the day, right?
Yeah. How long were you doing that?
So the internship was 6 months, and when I got on the rotation overnights, I was like, this ain't going to fly. I'm not going to stay here for long, which motivated me to get off there. And I think that's what they do. They think if you can hack the overnights, you're going to work harder to get off them. Yeah. And because I wanted to get into sport and there weren't a lot of females doing it at the time, I kind of weaseled my way over there and said, do you guys need some help? The Commonwealth Games were on at the time. And I said, I could stay back here and help you do pickups and things. And they said, okay, have a crack. And I ended up, my first thing was to go out to the Auckland Blues. And I remember I had to interview Mills Muliaina, like this young thing that hadn't done anything. And then they looked at the tape and decided I could ask questions, and then it all went from there.
Yeah. And then you became Tony Street.
And then I became a sports reporter doing all the things that the senior sports reporters didn't want to do. And I had a really hard boss, but that was really good because he taught us how to write really nicely. And then I started doing netball commentary after that. And everything kind of happens by chance, I think, in broadcasting. Like, the head of netball came down to the sports department and said, does anyone think that they can commentate netball because our person's sick? And I said, I'll do an audition, just put my hand up. And then it started from there, and she auditioned me, and I did a few games of commentary, and then I ended up hosting it. And from doing that, that's how I got my job hosting Breakfast TV.
That's wow. So cool. And I feel like that just goes to show the power of just putting your hand up and being
yes.
like, I'll just give it a go and see what happens, yeah. you know, because so many people yeah. are like, would be too scared to say, no, like, I'm not qualified yeah. or I'm not good enough.
I definitely wasn't qualified. And when I think back to that day where I said, I'll do an audition, it was just terrifying. I'd never commentated anything apart from sitting on the couch with Dad, you know. And I thought, oh, no, this is embarrassing. But you just do it, because what do you have to lose, really?
Exactly.
I already had a job, so it's not like I was going to be fired or anything. Maybe if I'd been really bad, they might have fired me. But it's just every little opportunity you get. And another opportunity I got was to sit and do the sports roundup when Pippa Wetzel and Paul Henry were hosting Breakfast.
So the golden years.
Yeah, the
golden
years. So I was the little sports girl, and I got to banter with Paul Henry. One of the highlights, when he was talking about how all women playing tennis were lesbians. That's what he threw at me one day.
Really?
And like, what am I supposed to say to that?
Just going back to the commentating, you know, when you did that stint of commentary and stuff, I've got like massive respect for commentators, because I just think like, I try and think about how hard it would be to do, like if I was trying to do it. And it's like, you've got to be so incredibly knowledgeable about all the players, the sport, and then to be able to just speak freely and interestingly without overthinking things.
Yeah.
And without saying something wrong, and without saying something that's like offensive to anyone.
It's the ultimate thinking on your feet.
Oh, it's amazing.
I know. It's so much fun, though. I really enjoyed it. So I was the broadcast commentator. So I was kind of commentating the play-by-play, and then I had the fancy netballers as my comments people. But it's really easy to get yourself in trouble. Like, I remember one time there was a player, and because it was the Australian series, I was commentating as well, and she was called Ingrid Dick. That was her name. And I remember one specific time, two players went up before, and I don't know what possessed me to say this, but I said, it's a dick sandwich, because she'd been sandwiched by two players, and it was just horrendous. And it came out, it's like, where do you go from there?
Oh my God.
Maybe that's why they moved me on to hosting instead of commentary. I don't know.
Oh, that is so hilarious. It's so good. It's one of those moments where it comes out and you just want to grab the words and just throw them back in. Yes. Like, oh, God.
I know. But like, but you say one bad thing and then it can be a headline the next day. Like, I know Justin Marshall, who commentates on the All Blacks, he often gets in trouble. But, you know, the split second, you've got to say something. So yeah. I understand how a slip of the tongue can easily happen.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you got any other things that you can remember that have kind of been a little bit shocking in your career? And
I actually swore on radio the other morning for the first time. I've never ever. I feel like I'm quite controlled in that respect because I'm often with people that aren't, and I'm always pulling them back into line, Mike Hosking.
What did you say?
I said the F word.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. The F-bomb.
And it was directed at Sam Wallace, and it was kind of under my breath, so I think I got away with it. He said something inappropriate, and for that split second, I forgot I was on the radio, and I thought it was just Sam and I bantering off radio.
Oh, my goodness.
F off, Sam. But we didn't get too many complaints, so I think I got away with it.
Oh, yeah. Luckily. But I guess one slip up in your entire radio career, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not too bad. I've had a couple of moments, like there was one night on 7 Sharp, and to this day I still think it was the medication I was on for this autoimmune disease I have. Mm. But every time I looked up on the auto cue, it was like I didn't trust myself to say the intro, and I kind of was stumbling over my words, and I stuttered a bit, which was not like what I would normally do. And I remember Mike, he even said on air, he goes, "What's up with you tonight? Have you need to lay off the wines before the show?" And in the ad break, I was like, "No, seriously, I don't trust myself. I don't know what's going on today." And I was fine the next night.
Yeah.
But I just had this like episode where every time I went to speak, it was slurred words.
Really?
It's like I was having a stroke. Weird.
Well, I wonder if it could have been the medication.
I actually think it might have been because I was having these infusions of really high doses of steroids and anti-organ rejection drugs. And I just think the combination of them that particular day might have made me go a bit weird.
Yeah.
I mean, that is some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
So, okay, take us back. Can you tell us more about your autoimmune disease and
what
all that's about?
When I was probably about 27, I'm 35 now, I started getting really bad asthma and eczema out of nowhere. Like, I had not one health condition as a child, as someone in my 20s. I'd played sport my whole life, never needed an inhaler. And it was really unusual. And I'd been covering the World Surfing Champs in New Plymouth. And to this day, I still think it might have been caused by a spider bite. That's quite a wild theory, and there's nothing to back that up. But I got a really bad spider bite on my back, and I had to get it all drained. And from that moment, I started getting eczema and asthma quite badly.
Wow.
And it was really weird. So I went to see doctors, like, why would this suddenly come on at the age of 26 when I haven't had it at all? And no one could really explain it. And they gave me, you know, steroid cream and inhalers and things. And it kind of just kept going sort of passively until I had my first baby at 29. And so I had my eldest, Juliet. It was probably about 4 days after she was born. I had a bit of a stiff neck and I was like, oh, I'm going to take just a Nurofen. I took a Nurofen and I took what's the one where you relax?
Ibuprofen?
Yeah, I had an ibuprofen and a Voltaren.
Oh, yeah.
Voltaren. And as soon as I took them, I like started projectile vomiting. My throat started closing over. I was having some sort of anaphylaxis. And it was quite a drama, as you can imagine, with a 4-day-old baby. And we had to go in the ambulance to the hospital and they had to zap me with steroids. So I had this anaphylaxis. And remember, I'd had Voltarens and Nurofen my whole life up until that point. So something had changed in my body and they didn't know what was going on. And anyway, it went away, but I still kept getting these weird symptoms of like burning in my gut and the asthma. And I'd had such bad episodes that I'd have to go to hospital. The asthma got so bad. Very weird for someone that had never had it.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until I had my second child 2 years later and I went into full-on organ failure. So totally fine, at home with my 6-week-old baby. I should be saying this to you guys right now. Totally fine.
I'm shaking in my boots.
Yeah, like birth and everything went great. I was like nailing the second time round, at home with my 6-week-old baby, and I suddenly just started projectile vomiting, this terrible stomach pain. It was like my body was going into some sort of anaphylaxis again. So again, I ended up in hospital, and this time I was there for a few weeks because they didn't know what was wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And my organs were failing, and I ended up having to have my gallbladder out. I had to have nasal polyp surgery, and no one could diagnose me. And that was the worst thing.
Like, you've got a new baby.
Oh, yeah, so I had to stop breastfeeding, and my husband was looking after the baby at home, Mackenzie, looking after her, and they were bringing her up to the hospital. But I was so like weak, I could hardly hold her. Bearing in mind, for the first 6 weeks, everything was totally fine. It was like something switched. I now know what happened. So when you get to 6 weeks, you come out of the postpartum period. Yeah. So you officially come out of it. And it's often when, if you've got an obstetrician or a midwife, they'll do their little check off and be like, yep, you're good to go. And it's when your immune system reboots itself, because while you're pregnant, it suppresses so that your immune system doesn't attack the baby. Mm-hmm. And for me, once it started rebooting, it started attacking my organs. So I've got this weird condition, it's called Churg-Strauss, which we then found out, where all your white blood cells are too elevated and they go crazy unless you take heavy doses of steroids and anti-organ rejection drugs to suppress your immune system. So I have just have an overactive immune system. And I never had this until my late 20s. So something's changed in my body, some episode. So I had this one specialist who we got so desperate because they basically just discharged me like, well, we don't know what's wrong with you. And I couldn't eat.
Were you terrified that it would happen again?
Oh, this time round it didn't go away. So I was just having this terrible burning sensation. The only thing that made me feel better was I would literally lie in the shower at 3 a.m. and it was the only thing that made me feel better. Can you imagine the state of it with like a little baby? Laugh now, but at the time it was pretty bad.
Poor thing.
Yeah. And there was this one specialist who I went and saw, and I had been referred by my obstetrician to him, and he said, let me look back at all your notes. He was a stomach specialist, gastroenterologist, and he went back through all my notes and he said, I think you've got an autoimmune condition. I think this is what it is. It's not my speciality. And he was right. And I went into the specialist in Churg-Strauss, the allergy sort of specialist, and he said, this is what you've got. You're going to have chemotherapy in the next week. This. It could have attacked your heart, and if it has, you're in big trouble. And it was like, whoa. Yeah. And luckily for me, because I was so young, we got it early, and it hadn't attacked my heart. But a lot of people, they don't find out till their 40s, and it's got to your heart. And by then, it does irreparable damage.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
So your own body just attacks itself.
Yes. And these autoimmune diseases and conditions are becoming so prolific. Like every second person seems to have some version of them.
Yeah.
And so then I went through 2 years of intravenous steroids, big doses of prednisone and mycophenolate, which is the anti-organ. It's like what they give to people who have transplants. So it suppresses your immune system so they don't reject the organ. And after doing that for a couple of years, I'm now in remission. And so I'm like totally fine. I'm still on a low dose of steroids, but no long-term damage, so I was really lucky.
Really lucky. Yeah. So that was all during your 7 sharp days, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I decided to carry on working because, you know, what else are you meant to do? Just sit at home and just be, because I put on a lot of weight and I had these weird sort of, they tell you that you'll get aggressive episodes, which Mike Hosking had a field day with. He goes, when are you just going to swing around and punch me, Tony?
But it's like they full roid rage.
Yeah, it's roid rage. Yes, because you're sitting there, like I had to go into the clinic and get intravenous and you sit there and you get this metallic taste in your mouth and, you know, it's like fully pumping you with all this horrible stuff that you need to keep you alive. But you go really red and you have like hot flushes, hot and cold flushes, really puffy from the roids. But I thought, well, I may as well keep working because I'm either going to be at home or with these episodes or I'll be doing something I really enjoy, you know? So I just decided to keep working. And it was probably the best thing because it kept my mind off it. It kept me doing something else.
And with all these steroids and things that were like suppressing your immune system, did you have to be really careful that you wouldn't expose yourself to other infections and sicknesses?
Really, really careful. And because your body's quite susceptible to things, like I said, well, can I take vitamin C to keep myself well? And he said, no, anything that boosts your immune system, we don't want you to take.
Oh, wow.
So you couldn't even do that. Which was quite bizarre. Mm. And then you had to take all these other pills because you can get brittle bones from it, and because the side effects of the steroids can be almost as bad as the actual disease if you're not careful and you don't manage it properly. But steroids are horrible things. Yeah. And I remember I talked to a few people that were on the steroids and they were like, yeah, I like piled on 10 kgs and it made me feel better. Because when I first went to a nutritionist, she said, well, no one tells you when you take steroids, no one tells you that you have to eat. But it's not really that. It's like you retain so much fluid. So, you know, you get this round face. It's a bit like people when they go through chemotherapy, they get that round bloated face look and you get that. Mm. So it's good to talk to people that have been there and done that. And they're like, you know, once you get off them, you'll come back. You know, you will come back eventually.
So yeah. So people that are taking steroids for bodybuilding and gym kind of stuff, does that have the same kind of effect, but they are working so hard on their muscles that that fluid kind of turns to the muscle?
I actually don't know. I wonder if they're different types of steroids.
That would have to be, surely.
I think they would be different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I know that anyone that gets really ill and has to take steroids, it's the intravenous ones that really do affect you.
Oh, sounds like a nightmare.
It was a bit of a nightmare, actually. And I felt a little bit cheated out of those early days with Mackenzie, my second baby. And she was a really good baby. And I always think it's like she knew that she had to be this great baby because mum couldn't be there all the time.
Aww.
Yeah. Luckily, I had those first 6 weeks with her to bond. And so I didn't feel, because a few people have said, well, when you're in hospital for all those weeks, did you feel like you were missing out? But I kind of had such a good bonding time for the first 6 weeks that I felt like we'd established that already.
You had a bit of a base.
Yeah. And she's like my cuddly little mudgy one now.
Your kids are amazing. Mm. They are just the sweetest.
They can be. I'll tell you the story about, I told on radio this morning actually about Mackenzie, talk of her being sweet. We were at tennis earlier this week, and this is how I knew she was my child. So the tennis coach said to all these little 4- and 5-year-olds, you all have to pick a food that you like, and when I hit the ball and call out your food, you have to hit it back to me. So all the girls were picking like blueberry, strawberry, apple, and it gets to her and she goes, cheeseburger.
Oh my gosh. She's a girl after our own heart.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a cheeseburger.
I know. Where the hell did that come from?
I feel like the other girls were lying, eh? Like
totally.
Blueberry, apple, you know, like favourite foods as a 4-year-old.
Yeah, put all those on a table. Chips. What are you going to go
for
first?
Are they going to lunch for?
Yeah.
Totally. Everyone's going for the cheeseburger. She's just honest about it.
Yeah. One thing that I was just thinking when I was sitting here listening to you talking about your autoimmune disease, that period of time that you were really in the thick of it and you were working the whole time, you've got 2 small kids and you're going through this horrible, you know, sickness. How did you stay positive, or what was it like for you mentally, and how did you kind of help yourself get through it?
I actually think the busyness helped me. Mm. I'm one of those sorts of people that I'm actually at my best when I'm busy and I'm juggling lots of things and I feel like I thrive like that. It's when I have time to stop and that things don't work out as well. And I didn't want to be sitting there thinking, oh, this is horrendous. And because when I first got the diagnosis and I was staring down the barrel of chemotherapy, and you know, if it's hit your heart, we had to go get the heart test, and if it's hit your heart, you're in big trouble and your life expectancy is going to be this. It was actually really confronting. It was really, especially when you've got this tiny baby, because you think, I need to be around for these kids. This can't be happening to me right now. So the way we all dealt with it in the family was to maintain this sort of level of busyness and business as usual. And I think that actually helped the time passed quite quickly when I was having to have all the treatment. And I can't imagine if I was literally sitting around at home just dwelling on the fact that I was had put on all this weight, and you know, it would have been horrible.
Mm. So into a downward spiral.
Yeah. And that's not to say, like, we had some really horrible moments, and luckily we had family support. If we didn't have that, it would have been horrible. The worst part of it, I think, and anyone that's gone through any sort of illness will know this, it's the logistics of all the appointments. Mm-hmm. So every single day, like, I live on Auckland's North Shore, and I would have to go to the special unit in Auckland Hospital to get all these specialised blood tests because they were monitoring things so closely. And every time you do that and you've got your tiny baby, it's like, well, am I going to get them in the car? And it's when they're meant to be having a sleep, and it's getting there in the waiting room for hours.
Palaver.
You know, it was a palaver, and it was every day. And that was the worst part. I remember when I didn't have to get the blood tests anymore, I was like, thank God for that. Because it was, at one point, it was every single day, you know, and then you sit there for the infusions and it's, you know, hours. And yeah, the logistics was the worst part by far. But I think just busyness was what kept you in distraction.
Here's a quick message from our sponsor, Subaru. Every new Subaru in New Zealand has all-wheel drive as standard. So this means that no matter what kind of road or surface you find yourself on, with Subaru's all-wheel drive, you can drive in confidence.
But what does all-wheel drive mean? Great question, Matt. Thanks for asking. All-wheel drive distributes power to all 4 wheels, which gives you twice the grip of those vehicles that aren't all-wheel drive or 4-wheel drive.
All-wheel drive is just one of many safety features that Subaru's 5-star safety range has, and it gives us comfort that baby Green will be travelling both safely and in style in our Subarus.
Another awesome thing people don't realise about Subarus is that you don't have to pay extra for all-wheel drive. It's included in the price.
So check out the Subaru all-wheel drive range at subaru.co.nz. So you're in remission now. How do you kind of try and keep it at bay if you can.
Yeah. Well, one thing that you've got to do, I think, is be really balanced and mindful of how tired you get. And I definitely know if I overdo it, I get, particularly when I was on all the high meds, I used to get this really weird sensation, like tingling across my back. And I could kind of tell that because you get really fatigued when you're on all these drugs. Like, it's a weird thing because the steroids actually give you lots of energy and then you suddenly crash. And I got to know how I could push myself and how I couldn't. And so now I've tried, I'm going big on exercise and trying to really watch what I eat. So I've been signing up for lots of these challenges that people are doing, and I'm in the middle of the F45 challenge at the moment. So the 8-week challenge, I'm on week 5. And it's quite a departure because I really like my food. And suddenly, like, I had to have a salad the other day that had no meat, which was like, what the hell? This is a side salad.
Did it fill you up?
It actually wasn't as bad as I thought. I think it was a mental thing. It was a Greek salad. It had a little bit of feta cheese. I think that was the protein. And it had like 3 cherry tomatoes and some lettuce and a little bit of red onion. I'm getting the meals provided like by the F45 people. And I think that is the key is this is what you've got to eat. You can't go over that limit. And then you kind of just eat it and then carry on.
Then you don't have to stress about it as well. You're just like, okay, cool, that decision's already been made. I don't have to worry about it.
Yes, it is what it is. But it's taken me a long time to get fit again because I used to be really fit before I got struck with the illness, and then I just didn't have the energy to do much anymore. And I used to do Mummy's Boot Camp religiously, and it was like my social interaction as well. And I'd go back to Mummy's Boot Camp and they'd just be all leaving me for dust. And I was like, this is horrible. So now I'm in remission, I can get fit again. It's like the best feeling. And I just had missed that feeling of that real rush of, you know, the blood pumping through your veins and a really good workout. And I do a lot more mix of exercise now. So, you know, a lot more weights. I never used to really do it. I'd go out for a run and that was it. So now it's short, sharp. So I'm not away from the kids for ages. So 40, 45 minutes. And I try and do that 4 or 5 times a week.
Yeah. I was going to ask you actually how you fitted in with having 3 kids.
Yeah.
Because I can hardly even fit it in now, and we don't even have one.
Yeah. So what I try and do is have, and this is one thing I've decided with food as well, is to have it all planned out and prepped. So I always do a lunchtime F45, which is at 12:15, and that's a really good one because I can get home from the radio, hang out with my little boy who's 9 months, and then whip away for 45 minutes, do that, come back, hang out with him again, and then do the school pickup.
Yeah.
So it's not like a big major. It's the best class because then I'm not away at dinner time when it's like the witching hour at home. So the middle of the day just works the best. And I block it in before the week starts. These are the sessions I'm going to do and try and work all meetings and work around it. But, you know, it's hard because schedules change. But I've tried to make it a priority and I think it helps balance everything.
Yeah, that's so true.
Just thinking about F45. F45 is really good in that you don't have to think, do you? You turn up and you know it's going to be 45 minutes.
Yep.
Everything's just sort of laid out in front of you. There's instructions. You don't have to think. And you just get a really good workout.
And you know that you can trust that it's giving you the all-over workout. So you know you're doing cardio one day, resistance the next. No muscle groups left out. You don't need to plan it. You just turn up and go. And 45 minutes is pretty quick, in and out, and that's what I like. And I wrangle it around time. So, for example, on a Saturday, I go to the 7 o'clock Saturday morning session. And it's not early for me because I get up at 4 for radio. It feels like a sleep-in.
Yeah.
And I get that done so that I'm back in time because then it's like kids' sport just dominates. Like, I'm coaching my daughter's netball team and we have swimming and we have tennis for the little one. So if I go early, I get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, Saturdays are a big day.
Saturdays are huge, especially now that I'm coaching.
Yeah.
It's serious stuff.
So what are you coaching?
I'm coaching my 6-year-old's netball team. Oh, undefeated, geez. Might I say.
Have you got a clipboard? And
I have got a clipboard. Yeah. In fact, I got mercilessly mocked for my clipboard because I ordered it and it's got a whiteboard on one side where you can run plays.
Awesome. Oh, that's great.
Can't say we're at that point yet where we're running plays.
It's only a matter of time. I
tell you what, the coaching of kids' sport, it's a whole new world. I've just delved into it and it is competitive and there are rules and it's intense.
Do the parents get really kind of a little bit aggressive, you know, like, why isn't my child on and like nobody passed to her? And
I'm keeping a ledger of who plays where and who's been subbed for that very day that I get that complaint, but I haven't hit it yet. But the organisers have definitely told us already, like, you can't stand on the baseline, you can't tell the kids this, that. It's very, you know, it's strict.
Oh, wow.
How do you navigate the whole thing about not wanting to put your child ahead of the other children?
I put my daughter on the bench for week one. I think you're way harder on your own child. Mm. She hasn't got player of the day yet either. And she said to me actually on the weekend, Mum, I think I deserve player of the day. I was like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. No,
she's got to work extra hard.
You cannot ask for player of the day.
Yeah, that's not what a player of the day does.
But I think it's unfortunate when your parent coaches your team because they're always going to be a bit harder on you.
Yeah.
It'll make her a better player eventually.
Oh, absolutely. It'll mould her into a strong player.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited that's going
to
be us.
Yeah, no. My mum used to help coach my rugby team.
Did she?
Yeah, didn't know the first thing about rugby. She'd just turn up, the gumboots on. She just liked to sort of get involved and wrangle the kids.
Yep. Yeah, because I feel like what she doesn't know about rugby, she would make up in droves with enthusiasm.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's honestly the most rewarding thing. People told me beforehand it's going to be one of the best things you do in your life. I was like, really? But already, you know, we've only had a couple of games and I feel like I'm really part of the kids' lives and my daughter's friends and it's just really cute. And now when I go to pickups, they're like, hi, Coach Tony. I'm like, cute.
That is so cute.
It's really cute.
Seeing like kids play sport is adorable. Like especially little boys playing rugby.
Oh, I know.
Isn't it just the cutest thing. Yep. And they're like all arms when they're running. They're just really.
I think if you've been sporty yourself, it's actually like reliving it all with your kids. Mm-hmm. And Saturday sport, it's like going back to where it all started. It's so great. I just can't get enough.
Yeah. Do you reckon that sports and in particular team sports are just like really important for kids' development?
Oh, I feel like when I think back to my childhood, so many of my life lessons came from sport. You know, the day you get dropped from a team that you expect to make and you've got to deal with that and you might have been one of the best players, but that's life. You don't always get picked, you know, all mm-hmm. those sorts of lessons. And that's why when I hear that they're not picking rep teams anymore and...
Are they not?
Well, they're not in rugby. Yeah, they're not in rugby.
Really?
Not until you get to 13. They've cut them for the younger kids. And there's a whole lot of research about kids dropping out because of it. And I'm sure that'll make sense. But I think it's really important to teach kids to lose and be resilient from a really young age. And I think sport's one of the key places, you know, you learn that. You learn that you're going to sit on the bench and you don't always get to play.
Yeah.
It's important.
Totally. And I think it's important to experience sports where there are other players around you that are better than you or worse than you.
Yes.
And how you work together as a team as well, because nobody wants to play with that person that is not a team player, right?
Yep. So true.
You've got to learn at a young age because that can manifest into an adult life. If someone is not good on the sport field, you're like, okay, says a bit about that person.
Yeah, it's true. And we were talking about it with cross country because cross country is happening for all primary schools at the moment. And there are some parents that let their kids not turn up for cross country. And I just think it's such a shame because I know everyone's not a good runner. Mm. But if you say you don't have to compete in cross country just because you're not good at maths, doesn't mean you don't do maths and you're not a good reader. So you just give up and don't try.
Mm,
why
totally.
Is sport any different?
Yeah.
Because some are good at sport and they might be the terrible speller in the class. And you've got to learn to give it a go. And if you come last, dealing with that will teach you the best life lesson.
So true. Because in life, you can't just not turn up to something that you don't want to do.
And I feel you go to university and you pass or fail.
Mm.
You pass or fail. And there's no compassionate consideration. There's no, but I wasn't good at that subject. It's like, no, that's the harsh reality of the world. And it's saying you go for a job and only one person's getting that job.
Mm. Exactly.
So if you don't learn it as a kid, it's going to, you know, we wonder why some adults can't handle it and get anxiety. And I think, well, maybe if you learnt that lesson as a child, you might be able to deal with it better later.
Yeah, totally. Like I remember at swimming sports at school, this is like a memory that stuck with me for life. I was like partly traumatized, partly proud of myself. So I'm not a good swimmer. I'm just a terrible swimmer.
Yet.
Yeah, I'm trying hard at the
good
moment.
Good girl.
And it was a breaststroke one and they said, oh, if anybody like wants to do this breaststroke race. And I was like, I can do breaststroke. I'm going to give it a go. You know, like I'm going to try. Surely I can't be the worst. And I remember swimming and honestly, everyone had finished. Everyone was out of the pool. I still had one whole length there and back to go.
No.
And I was so tired. Like I was
breaststroke is
absolutely
deceiving, that stroke.
It was so hard. And I was like puffing. I felt like I was going to drown. Everyone had already finished, but everyone around was like cheering me on.
Yep.
And they were like, you could do it. You could do it. And I was like half crying, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But I got out and the support I got was so lovely.
And you remember
everyone
that
around.
Moment.
Yeah. And everyone gave me a big hug and they were like, well done for giving it a go. And I was so embarrassed. Like beyond embarrassed, but at the same time I was like quite proud.
Yes.
So I was like, well, you know, I did it. Yeah. Like, I gave it a go. I was terrible. I came last by absolutely miles. But I got lots of hugs and people were really nice to me. So, yeah. You know.
It's probably because you put in such a huge effort and people saw that.
Yeah, well, they were like, she's tight. Really battling. Yeah.
Literally almost drowned.
But I have to say, when you become a parent, though, it is hard because it's really tempting when they say, I don't want to go to tennis practice and they're curled up on the couch watching a movie. It's really tempting to just let them stay home.
Yeah.
But I always keep thinking in the back of my mind, what's this going to
mean? Good for them in the long run.
When they're older.
Yeah. So true. Well, I guess it's like anything. Like, I feel like that sometimes too. But then you think, okay, no, I'll feel better afterwards. And yeah, it's definitely better.
I sometimes feel like I'm that parent and you're my child in those scenarios.
That is so true. So true. Yeah, but I'm like, I don't want to do this. I just want to sit on the couch and watch this.
And you're like, the motivator. Well.
Yep.
Yeah, think of how good you'll feel at the end.
Yeah. Actually, that'll be interesting when you guys have kids, who will be the motivator and who will be the lenient parent, because I always thought that I would be the more motivating parent and that my husband Matt would be the softie, but we're a bit the other way around.
Really?
I feel like I'm a bit of a softie and I never thought I'd be that parent.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think I'll be a bit softer than you. I think so. Well, judging by our cat parenting currently.
Yeah.
Yeah, you sort of lay down the
tough
rules.
Love.
Yeah,
tough love approach.
Mm. Yeah, whereas I can't, like.
You give in. We have a strict 6 p.m. feeding time.
This is going to keep you in good stead for this baby.
Yeah, okay, totally. So we've got a strict 6 p.m. feeding time. And
makes our lives sound so sad.
No, because the cats need routine, you see. And so the cats start meowing probably at about 5:30 normally.
And do you have to hold off until 6?
So, yep, so the idea is to hold off until 6. And so I'm very good at holding off until 6. I don't even hear them meowing, you know, I block it out. Whereas Maddie, she always gives in. And it's at the point now currently where
feeding them at like 4 o'clock.
We're feeding them about 4 p.m. And it's getting earlier and earlier. Yeah. And they're starting to meow like midday. You're giving them treats during the day. Like,
and you've made a rod for your own back.
I really have.
Tell you what, if you do that with your child, you're in for a world of pain.
Well, it's good that we're doing like crash course with the cats. And so then when baby Green comes, we're like, well, we learned from Brian,
yeah,
you know, to not do that. Otherwise the baby's going to start meowing.
What about pets for kids when they're growing up? Do you guys have pets?
Oh, this is the bane of my existence. So I grew up with lots of pets on a dairy farm, and we had the inside dogs and we had border collies like outside. And,
working dogs.
Yeah, we had goats and we had lambs.
Out-mustering.
Yep. Out-mustering, hard-working. Yeah. Well, so my girls are pet obsessed. Like, they wouldn't like nothing more to have a pet right now. And they go down to Nan and Grandad's and they are just obsessed with the black lab and they're pleading for us to get a pet. And Matt, my hubby's decided that it's not a good idea until our youngest is at least 3. So Lockie's got a couple of years to go and the girls are just desperate for one, because we feel like we travel so much now and we've got a hands full with 3 kids. It's like another newborn to the mix.
Yeah.
Like you'd be travelling with a full farm.
Yeah, almost. But I nearly caved. I nearly caved on Mackenzie's birthday and got them a kitten.
Well, cats are pretty low maintenance.
Yeah.
Like, cats essentially look after themselves.
They do, eh?
Yeah. That's what I'm told. Yeah, they're really not hard at all.
But then Matt says cats aren't a real pet and he wants a dog.
Oh, he's one of those. Okay.
He's one of those. He's like, let's just wait for the dog.
I feel like I was one of those.
Yeah, and it's just because you haven't had the right cat. That's the thing.
Yes, that's what I think too.
Yeah.
And then every time I go, okay, let's just get them a lame version of a cat or dog. Like, let's get them a fish or a bird. And it's not up to scratch.
Nah. Yeah.
I'd just rather wait.
You don't get that interaction. They don't know that you're a
Well, they're just kind of like fluffy blobs, aren't they, really?
No. Well, like the fish isn't. The fish isn't fluffy.
No, and every parent I talk to says the fish just end up dying.
Yeah, no, fish suck.
Yeah.
But then that's kind of a good learning thing as well, to be like, if you don't feed things, they die.
Mm. Sea monkeys. Get sea monkeys.
Oh, yeah, sea monkeys.
Speaking of cats, I ran over a cat last weekend.
Did you? On purpose?
Oh, my God.
Not on purpose. It was so traumatic.
Did it die?
So I was driving along like a little suburban street, dropping my friend off. It was after a pink ribbon breakfast. And this cat just like...
I like how you put that in there, the pink ribbon breakfast.
I've been in a terrible game.
So you've done something good.
I'm not a murderer, okay?
So, and this cat, like literally I was going 40 Ks because I was about to drop my friend off, and this beautiful looking black and white cat, came out from this construction site, didn't look, and literally went right under my wheels. And it was horrific.
That's my worst nightmare.
And I looked to the right and he'd like gone an extra couple of metres and then collapsed in his driveway. Oh. It was horrendous. And then I went over, first of all, like, is he going to be alive still? And he was dead. And then I had to go into the house and tell this man that I'd killed his cat.
Oh my.
Horrifying.
Wow.
And I said to him, do you own a black and white cat? And he goes, have you run it over? And I was like, yes. Tears coming in my eyes. And luckily, he must have felt so sorry for me. And he said,
I know.
It makes me want to cry thinking about it. He said he's a really skittery cat and he runs across the road all the time. He goes, I was waiting for the day he was going to get hit, which made me feel slightly better.
Yeah.
But I felt sick all weekend. It was just hideous.
How awful.
Luckily, the kids weren't in the car. And he didn't have any kids either because I thought, oh, no, what if a child comes to the door? It's like, have you killed pet Brian?
Oh,
like, you know.
God, imagine.
Oh,
you
sorry,
poor thing.
Grim story.
That's awful for you, though, as well. That's awful for everyone. I can't even imagine. It's actually my worst nightmare.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, it was not great.
Oh, yeah. Some friends of ours ran over their own dog.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it didn't die. They just, like, broke its tail a bit. So it's got, like, a wonky tail. But, I mean, that's awful. That's even worse.
I can think of even worse. Some other friends of ours, speaking of, you know, animal mutilation, they were doing some cooking.
Oh, yeah, this is bad.
So
what?
Gary, this is our friends Gary and Kate. So Gary...
Oh, don't name
No, shame. We're naming and shaming Gary. Hope you're listening to this. So Gary's in the kitchen cooking and they were cooking something that used a lot of oil. So had this hot oil in the pan and he didn't want to tip it down the sink because he didn't want to block up the sink, which can happen with oil. So he went outside and threw it in the bushes. And as he threw the boiling water in the bushes, the cat was in the bushes and it landed on the cat's back. And then scalded the cat. The cat almost died, went to hospital. It was like the most traumatic thing.
Truly horrific.
Yeah.
I know.
And the cat's great.
Does it have a scarred back?
Yep. Yep.
But it's alive
horrendous.
And thriving and it's happier than ever.
Yeah, so well done, Gary and Kate.
Gary, that could have
How
been...
How awful, though,
okay,
eh? Imagine throwing hot oil onto your own cat by accident.
No,
actually, you know, to make it worse, I don't actually think it was their cat at the time. They were looking after the cat. The friends of theirs.
Cat sitting.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, now it's theirs.
Yeah.
The owners were like, oh, you know. Almost killed our cat, you might as well have it.
Oh, yeah, just take it with all its medical bills. Thank you very
much. Yeah, yeah, it would have been so expensive. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, but anyway, the cat's happy. It's, you know.
Good.
Everyone as well.
Everything's back.
Yeah, but your one, not so much.
No, yeah. My one didn't have that chance to recover.
Yeah,
that's awful.
No.
Anyway.
Hey, speaking of that, I want to know about a bit more about nutrition and maybe dietary things and stuff like that, because surely that's, you know, a huge part of your journey with your health, right?
Yes.
Yeah?
So I love food and it's like the blood
of
my life. It's the best.
Mm.
And if I didn't have to worry about it, I would just be eating all the yum stuff all of the time.
Wouldn't we all?
Yeah. And I've tried multiple diets over my life to not only lose weight but to be healthy. And actually it was a kick up the pants when I got the autoimmune disease to actually look at it more closely. Because I was quite a sporadic dieter. Like, I'd be really, really healthy and then, you know, have total blowout and, you know, get a McDonald's combo. Mm. So now the absolute key for me is to have it prepared beforehand and have it portioned out, because I feel like maybe it's being a dairy farmer's daughter. Portions were always quite large at my house, you know. Mm. It was, you know.
I think that's pretty common throughout New Zealand.
It's a Kiwi thing,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it really is. The meat and three veg. And
we're big eaters.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that aspect is good. I think it's cool that we do have meat and three veg as, like, kind of the staple in New Zealand.
Yes.
We're very lucky that that's part of our culture.
But we just all eat too much, don't we?
Mm.
And that's actually one thing this eating the portion control shows you, how you actually don't need as much food as what you realise. But I got into quite a bad, I think being a sports person when I was young as well, you're so active all the time, I kind of ate what I liked and big portions, and then I married a rugby player who could eat double me and we just ended up eating the same
eating
thing.
Together, yeah.
Yeah, eating together. And both of us now are so much more mindful. And the biggest revelation has been the carbohydrate thing. I grew up eating potatoes and pasta, and now I can see how empty calories a lot of that is. I'll still eat those things, but you just don't need the heaping bowls of it anymore. And I notice how it makes me feel. So I try and limit gluten. I've recently discovered almond milk, so I'm not having as much dairy. Just noticing how...
Coming from the dairy farm.
I know.
How's your dad?
Dad's retired now. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
He now grows almonds.
Yeah. No daughter of mine is having almond milk.
But I think, too, when you go through a bit of a health scare, you just notice how certain foods make you feel and how much different it is. And then you have kids and you're like, I want to have their habits so much better than what mine were growing up.
Yeah.
But obesity is such a massive problem in this country. And I actually take a bit of responsibility to try and be a good role model in that respect as well, because we have the power to be able to help educate other people. And we have the means. I'm very lucky. I can go and buy whatever food I like. So I should be eating healthy food, you know?
Yeah.
And it's trying to get that through the heads. And I try and do that with my kids, that these are the better food choices for you to have. And I'm definitely not going to be one of those parents that says you have to finish everything on your plate, because I don't think that's a good mentality to have.
I don't think so either.
No.
Yeah.
No, we've talked about it, haven't we, Matt?
Yeah, because I think then that carries with you throughout the rest of your life, you know, that you have to finish all your food all the time. Like, even if you're full, it's like, no, can't leave anything on the plate, just get it down.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's necessarily a healthy way to look at food or meals, you know. It's like, if you're not hungry, you're not hungry. Don't force it.
Absolutely agree. And I look at kids that are overweight now, and the reason they are is because their parents aren't controlling what they eat. You have so much control as a parent over what your kids eat. And if they are overweight, it is your fault, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you've got to do something about it.
Yeah.
And I'm not perfect by any stretch. Like I say, I could quite easily have burgers all day if it was left up to not putting on weight, not being unhealthy. But I think you get better as you get older, because you just realise what food actually how it makes you feel.
Yeah, because then as soon as you start to eat better for the way that you feel, then you feel so good you don't actually want to eat badly again.
And it's actually a mental thing. It's a mental thing. And I mean, I'm in an industry where your appearance, you know, people get to see you, and you know, you put on the slightest bit of weight and they notice, and they'll tell you about it on social media.
Do I?
And so you're heightened in that respect as well. And I'd never be someone that would get hung up on my weight, because I don't think that's healthy either. But I do think you've got to have a good balance between positive body image and acknowledging that actually I am carrying way too much weight and it's really unhealthy for me.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that's a reality.
I think that's so important to be talking about that, because there is so much out there about self-love and loving your body, and absolutely I'm all for that. But when it comes to your health, it's really important to worry about.
And you can totally argue that, like, well, actually, by loving your body properly, you want to look after it, you know? Because you can say like, oh, I love my body for kind of all its flaws and everything about it, and I totally get that. But at the same time, it's like, if you truly love it, you have to look after it.
One thing you mentioned just before, or at least it got me thinking about, just like people coming at you on social media and all that sort of stuff. How do you deal with all that?
I'm quite a sensitive sausage and it's taken me years to get better at it, but it still affects me, I have to say. So I've been in broadcasting now for 15 years, and I remember the first dose I got of it was when I went to the Olympics. And I was early 20s, and I was in a really challenging role because I was the roving reporter. And so I had to interview the athletes when they first hopped out of the pool or they'd just finished their race. And you're faced with this unique position where, like, let's say one of our swimmers had dipped out in the heat, hadn't swum their PB. So essentially their campaign was a failure in their eyes and the eyes of everyone that had paid lots of money to help them get there.
Yeah.
And so you're in this position, they've just hopped out of the pool, they're devastated, and you've got half of the country wanting you to ask them what went wrong, and the other half wanting you to be sympathetic with this person that's just blown their campaign. It's really hard, because what way do you go?
Mm.
And it was really hard. And I felt like I did as best as I could, but every single person you interviewed at that time, you'd either get abuse for not being hard enough on them, or you'd get abuse for being too soft. It was like a lose-lose. And I remember just being... this whole new world opened up of this criticism you get for this job in the public eye. And I don't know whether I was naive thinking it wouldn't come, but I just thought, wow. And I remember in tears in China ringing mum going, I can't do this job.
Oh, man.
And mum was like, stop reading the comments. And this was before Instagram and Twitter really blew up. I think you could look on Facebook. And of course, I was looking every day what people are saying about me. And you might have really nice comments, but the few biting ones really stuck with me. And that was quite a turning point, because it opened my eyes to how vulnerable you are and how vicious people can be.
Mm.
And I've been in some of the most high-profile jobs in this country now, breakfast television, Seven and Seven Sharp. They're the most watched TV shows in the country, and you get it at all angles. And you get it, like, for so many different things, what you're wearing, what you look like, for being. One thing that really used to irk me in the early days is how I couldn't get away with saying the same thing as my male counterpart. So if I had a strong opinion, it was seen, because I was a bit younger, I would be called bolshy, and, you know, whereas, you know, whoever I was sitting next to could say it. They get criticised for different things, but that used to irk me, and they'd say, oh, that's such a ditzy comment, and I would think, well, I've got this degree, and I was head girl of my high school, and I was smart, and how dare you call me ditzy, you know? But then you do learn strategies to deal with it. So now, 15 years later, I don't read through the comments. I completely just leave them alone, because it doesn't serve any good purpose. No. The people that are going to give you feedback are your bosses, and people will give it to you on the street, and overwhelmingly you'll get positive stuff, but I used to dwell far too much on the negative.
And it's the feedback of your bosses and your family and friends that actually matters.
Yes it does. And I think if you're someone that likes to be liked, you almost want to get to the bottom of, where is this hatred coming from? Because I'm a good person, so why are you being so vile online? But then you realise that could be any Joe blog. People love to have opinions, they love to criticise, and you have to put it into that box. And there is actually a comfort in knowing that everyone gets it. And I remember feeling quite good about that, because Peter Williams said to me, Tony, I've had this for years. And I thought, well, you're one of the most classy broadcasters in this country, and if you're getting it, then, you know, we all are, you know. And so it's comfort knowing that everyone's in the same boat. But that's not to say, you know, I'm not immune to it all. We'll still have people text in the radio, and occasionally there'll be a comment that makes me feel sick, and I think, why am I being affected by this? I shouldn't be. But I think it's also human nature as well to be affected. But it does worry me, because I think if that's how it makes me feel, and I'm someone that's used to getting the criticism, I've got good support, then no wonder we've got, you know, kids at school really depressed, because they don't have the brains to be able to deal with it.
No, or the life experience, anything.
What I think is that, you know, people are in positions like us sitting here, who we're exposed ourselves, and like you said, we're very vulnerable, and you know, we're now kind of used to this interaction with other people and this barrage of comments and things like this, most of which are positive. I feel that that's exactly almost, you know, what the kids are going through at school.
Yes.
And it's something that we didn't have that when we were going through school. But now I feel like
It was face-to-face. Like, it was a bit less, and you could go home and it would stop. Yeah. But now it's just – and it's a lot more brutal now, because it's not face-to-face, and so people have a lot more courage.
You're
just saying it to a phone or a laptop.
You're right. I think the vile side of it has got worse. And I think everyone knows that you get comments for all sorts of reasons. It's like the popular kid at school will have jealousy. But when it can come to your phone and you're alone when you get it, that's when it's bad. And that's why, I don't know what the answer is there, but it's something that I think all of our kids need to be aware of very young, and to have that resilience, because if I still get affected by it 15 years later, and I'm in a job where I expect it, you know, I don't really know what the answer is.
No, I don't know what the answer is either, but I think talking about it and being open to learning about it and educating ourselves and educating people around us is, you know, start of the process of...
Yeah.
But it's also difficult, because it's continually evolving. And so by the time we kind of catch up with it, I think it will have moved on. But yeah, I definitely think talking about it is part of the key.
Yeah, and being in it with lots of other people, I think, is the key, because then you realise that these people are going to crack at anyone for any reason, and it's not just you. I think if you realise it's not just you, you're not alone. I think, you only get that by talking about it.
Yeah.
So true. And so to wrap up, should we ask our final question?
Let's do it.
Ooh. Okay. Tony, if you could have only three foods for the rest of your life, what would they be?
Oh, this is big.
It's a really, we already know what McKenzie's one would be.
Yeah, cheeseburgers.
I would definitely have hot chips.
Yeah. Oh,
hot
great.
Chips are so delicious. They're my weakness. I'd have hot chips. I'd have chocolate.
Mm-hmm. What sort?
My favourite chocolate at the moment, I really like coconut rough.
Oh, yeah.
I was just eating that last night.
Were you?
Yep, Whittaker's.
So good, yeah. So coconut rough chocolate, hot chips, and does liquid count?
Yep.
Yeah, I think so.
I'd definitely have wine then.
Oh, my God.
Chips, chocolate, and wine.
A good rest of your life.
I love this question, because you get so many different answers.
People say healthy stuff.
Yeah, a lot of people say healthy stuff. I'm one of those health nerds that, you know, very, you know, well thought out from the health side of things.
I just thought of, what are the things that before I die, that's how I was thinking.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same. I think I went like bolognese and then something else. I can't even remember.
Oh, cheese. Yeah, you broke down like a bolognese into different... And I said you can't have a bolognese because it's just the ingredients of the food.
And then
you
just, you just chose cheese, mince,
yeah,
and
so
pasta.
Yeah, so you just chose mince, tomato and something else.
Oh, my.
It was going to be terrible.
God. I do love a good spaghetti bowl, though.
Oh, same. Mm. I think it's my ultimate favourite food. And it has been since I was, like, born.
And it's such a good comfort food.
Yeah. I lived on it. Spag bowl and fish fingers was like all I would eat.
Now you'd have it with zoodles though, wouldn't you?
Well, I would. Sometimes I'd branch out, you know, and have like a full wheat noodle, which is a bit exciting. I love zoodles, but it's never going to be the same.
No, I agree.
And it's just a fact, you know.
Yeah. See, whereas I love them.
Yeah.
And I don't like
But do you
like
love them as
noodles.
Much as pasta?
Nah, see, I grew up with pasta as well. I don't know what it is, but I find pasta really boring now. Like, it just doesn't do it for me.
I love it so much.
I know, which annoys me, because I used to love pasta.
I wish I didn't.
Mm. Like, if spaghetti bolognese was a star sign, it would be your star sign. You're that. That's so you know?
Yeah, it's me at my core. So well, I'm probably made up from spaghetti bolognese, because it's literally all I ate.
Probably.
When I was younger.
You would have been the kid at Tina's practice that says spag bowl.
Yeah, you would have been spag bowl. Yeah. Or a fish finger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you so much, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Is there any way people can sort of follow you, check in on you, what
you're
up to?
Yes, they can follow me on Instagram if they like. What's my handle? I don't even know.
You've got your torchlight on the phone.
Oh, wow. Where have I been before this? I don't even know how to turn that off. So that shows you. So Tony M Street on Instagram, you can follow me.
Okay, cool.
Or send me a direct message, I don't mind.
Or listen to you on the radio.
Or listen to me on the radio, or when I fill in on 7 Show.
Cool,
thanks, Tony.
All right, bye. Thanks for listening.
Thank you indeed. This podcast is brought to you by Raw Collective. And for any updates on our podcast or any of the other podcasts under Raw, head to rawcollective.co or you can follow them on Instagram at raw_collective.co.
But wait, before you go, please subscribe to our podcast and also rate it and review it. Leave a nice little message. Leave a smiley face, maybe an emoji.
Or tell your friends. It's super easy. It takes 2 seconds and it would mean so much to us.
Bye.
Bye.